Join me on May 13th to the 21st on our Paraguay Investors Tour. Earlier this year, I unveiled an exciting real estate project in Paraguay that sold out in one day. Now, you can come down to Paraguay side by side with me to learn about what everyone was so excited about and even see new exciting projects you can participate in. We will also examine residency, banking, safety, and many other important aspects of a proper Plan B. Join us for this luxury tour to Paraguay on May 13th to the 21st, and tickets include all food, alcohol, transport, activities, hotel stay, and domestic flights. For more information, please email Susan James from my team at trips@expatmoney.com or visit our tours page at expatmoney.com. Email trips@expatmoney.com for more information. All Expat Money subscribers are welcome to join me for this trip. Seats are filling up fast. Email trips@expatmoney.com.
We all dream of seeing the world, but the realities of living somewhere outside your place of birth can be daunting, to say the least. Welcome to the Expat Money Show, helping you make the most out of your overseas career through conversations with successful expats on investing, entrepreneurship, self-improvement, and continual education, all while sharpening your financial acumen. Now please welcome your host, with over 20 years of overseas experience, Mikkel Thorup.
Hey everyone, I am so excited about today's episode and I can't wait to get into it and share it with you. But I just wanted to remind you before we get going today to visit expatmoneyshow.com and sign up for my private newsletter, EMS Pulse. Right now we are sharing the weekly episodes from the podcast, but also a ton of other products and services that we're going to be offering, lots of language programs, lots of tips and tricks for being an expat, whether you're a first-time expat or an expat hopeful. There's just so much going on at expatmoneyshow.com. I really hope that you get a chance to come and visit us, join the newsletter, and then from there, maybe join our Facebook group at expatmoneyforum.com. Lots happening. I really want to share it with you guys, and the best way to stay connected is through these two sites, expatmoneyshow.com and expatmoneyforum.com. Thanks so much. Enjoy today's episode. Cheers.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Mikkel Thorup. This is the Expat Money Show, and today's guest is the editorial director for International Man, where he works alongside Doug Casey and Dr. John Hunt, helping individuals around the world to realize their internationalization goals. During his professional career, he has written from more than 85 countries, a dozen of which he called a temporary home. His columns have appeared in well-known libertarian outlets such as Mises.org, Fee.org, LouRockwell.com, and The Daily Reckoning, which he managed for 5 years with Bill Bonner and Addison Wiggin. He speaks regularly at conferences around the world on topics including philosophical anarchism, internationalization, and the decentralization revolution. Please welcome to the show, Joel Bowman. Joel, how are you doing?
Ready.
It's so great to have you on the show. Why don't you take a couple minutes and kind of walk us through your backstory? How did you become an expat and when did you first move overseas and start getting involved in learning about the economy in such a different and interesting manner?
Oh, wow. Okay. So a couple of minutes. I might need a little longer. Like yourself, I've been sort of moving about for the last couple of decades. My accent is Australian. It's a little buried from having spent so much time abroad. But I first moved from Australia. I took the oft-trodden path back to London, thinking at the time naively that I was blazing a new trail, only to find when I got to England that I'd arrived in a place that was nicknamed Kangaroo Court, in Earl's Court, and found myself more or less swimming in the same stream as every other Australian that wanted to get out of Australia at that time and see the broad world. So I shortly after moved to the US, early on I became involved with a publishing company over there out of Baltimore, known as Agora. Some of your readers may know some of their publications. And this was early on in kind of my professional career. I started out at the very bottom of the kind of editorial heap over there, and mostly just spent my time reading research papers, reading economic newsletters, and really just being super energized by the kinds of you know, out of the box thinking that I was hearing from what to me was, you know, one of my first experiences with a kind of alternate media. You know, you go through university and college, and you're given a very, very specific and very constrained view of, you know, subjects like economics, like politics. And, you know, there are obviously views that are self-serving to public institutions like universities. So that's not particularly surprising. But this was really my first introduction to ideas that ran against the grain, particularly with regards to economics. So that was kind of, I guess, the beginning of an adventure for me that's taken me to, I don't know, 85, 100 countries, and I've lived in a bunch. So that was inspiration for the start, I would say.
Well, I think it's really interesting because I've had a lot of different people, and we've talked about economics on the show, but a lot of times it's the overall general philosophy and understanding, you know, what is Austrian economics and things like this. But when I was doing my research on you, I saw that you've had a lot of like real world economic like experiences. So I'm really excited. I'm hoping that you can talk me through these a little bit today. I know before the interview started, we were chit-chatting about your time in Dubai. I'm in Abu Dhabi, so we would have been next door neighbors if we were here at the same time. Can you talk me through a couple of these types of like real world economic learning experiences that you had?
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, it's interesting that we even have the kind of separation between the theoretical and the practical, because economists now known as kind of the dismal science, not quite a soft science, but you know, not something certainly like physics or chemistry, where there are very, very hard-won, evidence-based, peer-reviewed answers. We have something like economics, where we now have all models and theories about how things work or how governments think they ought to work. But the role of an economist, originally in classical times, was as a moral philosopher. And it was, you know, these people were sitting around and thinking about what to do, but they were also thinking about it in very practical terms. You know, how economies actually work on the ground. So I was kind of interested in less of the theoretical side and more of the, you know, getting your hands dirty, going to places, you know, where commerce is underway. So shortly after having spent some time in Baltimore working with Agora, I moved to New York, where I worked just off Wall Street with a very dear friend of mine and mentor, Eric Fry. And we published a newsletter called The Rude Awakening. And it was, again, another kind of baptism by fire for me, because I was working in a corner office with 100 or so other traders and, you know, options experts and commodities gurus and, you know, all the kind of people that you see on, you know, the Wall Street movies and that kind of stuff, which was completely amazing to me. And I was watching trade happen in real time. You know, with real money on the line and, you know, people calling real clients and making real decisions that affected people's, you know, people's livelihood. And after a couple of years of that, though, even that seems to be, you know, one step removed from reality, because, you know, this was in the days before high frequency trading necessarily, but it still seems, you know, not quite where the rubber met the road. So after being in New York for about a year, maybe a year and a half, we'd been writing a little bit about commodities and gold and things like that, and not just as an investable asset, but as a historical form of money. And so I thought, you know, what better place to move to in the world to learn about this metal and its history than to Dubai, aka the City of Gold. So I moved over there in 2007, and I got a job moonlighting at a business desk there. And I used my spare time, my weekend time, to go over the Deer Creek and visit the gold suits there and sit with the Indian, you know, and Arab gold traders who had their eyes glued to the spot price all day and who would measure out their ingots and, you know, roll up their fat wads of dirham, of a local government currency. And, you know, they would be wheeling and dealing all day. And it was just a really exciting atmosphere. to be in. And it was very educational in the way that I don't think I necessarily could have gotten from a textbook or even sitting next to commodity traders behind a computer screen. You know, there's something about owning and trading physical metal when you hold it in your hand. It's a very, very different experience than watching, you know, digital numbers flit across a screen or reading text about it in a book. So that, I guess that was maybe my first real kind of experience in how commerce and how economics works.
And did you find, like, I've been to the gold souks over here. Did you find mostly it was gold that was used in jewelry that was going to and from India, or were you guys dealing much in bullion, or what was your observations?
Well, I was dealing mostly in bullion. And when I say dealing, you know, this was the very beginning of my kind of professional career. So I wasn't betting cattle stations or anything like that, but I was, you know, migrating some of my savings over into gold bullion and, you know, and using that as kind of an investable asset, I guess. People will no doubt fact check this, but I think I want to say around the time of 2007, I want to say gold was around the $500 to $600 per ounce range, something in that order. And so it was a very real time lesson for someone who was young, who didn't have any money at the time, to put their savings in something that not only held its value, but at that time was appreciating somewhat against this kind of macroeconomic backdrop that we had of, you know, fiat currencies losing, you know, in a kind of race to the bottom. This was only a year before the global financial crisis. So we saw, you know, market turmoil everywhere. And it was a real lesson in, you know, how to safeguard one's wealth, meager as it was for me at the time, against, you know, this kind of global catastrophe. It really is, in a very, very practical sense, the best form of insurance. So there was, obviously I was living there with my then girlfriend at the time, so I can't say that I wasn't at all in the jewelry section, buying trinkets and earrings and that kind of thing. But I'm happy to report since that then girlfriend is now current wife. So not only did gold pay off investment wise and savings wise, it was also a pretty good gift.
Very nice. Well, it's an interesting point you just made there, because you said at the beginning you had meager funds, but the lessons that you learned, it's not really important. If you're learning the lessons with $1,000 or you're learning the lessons with $1,000,000, it's not, the lesson is not 1,000 times more because you're investing or speculating or gambling or everything with $1,000,000. If you're learning it, you're learning it, you know, and these are things that you're going to be able to put into practice for all your life going forward. So I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. And those, you know, those lessons scale. I mean, they apply to, as you said, somebody who has very, very little and is just starting out. And then they also apply to somebody who, you know, is maybe a little further along in their career and they've made a bit of money and they want to, you know, ensure that they don't watch it kind of blow away in the gusts of the next crisis. So yeah, these are lessons that you kind of remember all of your life. If I forget what the saying is, but something, you know, you recall a certain amount of what you read, certain percentage of what you read, and a certain percentage of what you hear. But things that you're doing, you know, I've worked with Doug Casey on International Man, and learn by doing is one of his favorite sayings. But when you're actually involved in the day-to-day transaction of something, when you're, you know, when you're involved in it in a more practical way, I find those lessons stick for a lot longer.
So when you moved over to the United States originally and you were working with Agora, you mentioned that you were mostly just reading reports. Were you working as an analyst then, or, and then similar type of thing in New York, or like, I'm trying to piece together how these types of things brought you to the real life, living, breathing, seeing, touching with your own hands, something like gold. And I have some other things that I want to ask you about afterwards, but I want to get this piece so I understand here.
Yeah, sure. So it was it wasn't anywhere near as exciting or flashy as being an analyst. I moved over and took a job answering phones, essentially, for like customer service. And I was so terrible at that job, so ill-equipped, both temperamentally and just with regards to my concentration span for answering phones all day, that I eventually, after having been there for a couple of months, I decided that, I was reading these, rather than answering phones, I was reading the economic newsletters and journals that the company was publishing. And so I very quickly decided I wanted to be a part of that world rather than a part of the customer service world necessarily. Not that they're entirely separate, but so I invited myself on a whim along to an editorial meeting that was held. They used to have editorial meetings once a month where they would have all these, huge names in the industry, many of whom I'm sure your readers would probably recognize now. They would, fly them in from various parts of the country and around the world. And they would sit down once a month to, it was kind of a cerebral nerve center of the business, this big kind of brain trust that would hash out these, what to me at the time were very, big kind of exotic, sexy, ideas. I'm not sure that many people provide those adjectives for economic analysis. For me, it was just really exciting. And there was a buzz in the room. There was an energy, there were debates that occurred over this kind of big oak, boardroom table. And it was in a very old building. And anyway, so I just found that was really exciting. And so I invited myself along to one of these meetings and I just said, hey, I would like to be part of this. And so it was a couple of weeks, maybe a month later, that I got a call up from one of the fellows that was sitting around the table, and he said, okay, let's see some writing samples, let's hear some of your ideas. And I'd mentioned to him that I'd spent a long time both reading the various analyses that these gentlemen were producing, and I was fairly familiar with their various investment philosophies and even down to their individual stock positions and things like that. So I'd essentially done quite a bit of homework, and I was willing to move from Baltimore at the time where we were to New York within a couple of weeks and sort of apprentice myself to this gentleman. So it was part just serendipity, just being in kind of the right place at the right time. And then I guess also part of just putting myself out there and wanting to be part of something that I found interesting and valuable.
So that tenacity that really drove you forwards, and they must have taken notice.
Or just dumb luck, either way.
And then when you moved over to Dubai, were you still working with Agora, or had you left them by that point?
No, I was still working with Agora. I was writing the Rude Awakening publication, which was the morning edition of another publication called The Daily Reckoning. I would produce the Rude Awakening nocturnally, and then during the daytime, I was writing for a business desk called Arabian Business down in Dubai, and it was an interesting kind of mix, because during the day I would, when you're in countries like United Arab Emirates or other, let's say smaller population, smaller economies, it's not particularly difficult to chain and start, meeting influential people and interviewing them and getting to know the ins and outs of the area. So on the back of the Arabian Business job, I got to interview, a bunch of people who were involved in, some economic decision making in the Emirates at the time. And I remember in 2008 speaking with the head of S&P ratings agency for the MENA, Middle East, North Africa region. And I remember asking him about the property market there. I remember this is mid 2008, early 2008, perhaps. and watching him assure me that everything was fine, that liquidity levels were exactly what they expected, and you know, debt ratios were well within their, you know, the limits that they'd modeled, and sitting, you know, across the desk from him and thinking, this is absolutely not true. This is completely detached from my own experience, you know, living in Dubai and that kind of thing at the time. So anyway, it was, I had this kind of twin life where during the nighttime, I'd, you know, sit down at my computer and tap away my opinion pieces for the American publication, telling them what I was seeing on the ground and what my real world experiences were. And then the following day, I'd, you know, go into work and, you know, report business as usual for the local publication. So that was an interesting dichotomy.
I would say so. Absolutely. So when you decided to leave Dubai, did you go back to the States? Where did you head? What was kind of the, I'm trying to get the map here, the flight plan of where your writing and things have taken you around the world.
Okay. So yeah, I left Dubai in 2008. I'd actually written a couple of pieces that I sent to a publisher in England, and those pieces were featured in a journal called the Fleet Street Journal, and they were not necessarily in line with what might have been accepted with the local media at the time. They were a little critical of the Dubai governing and the way that the unraveling economic mess that was being handled. And so I eventually received those pieces back through a long list of emails that through which they had been forwarded. So they made their way back from England through the expat community and then around the local media in Dubai. And I just thought it was a little bit of, I didn't necessarily want to be in Dubai when those pieces, you know, if they got kind of fleshed out. So we left, I moved with my girlfriend then out to the Far East, and we spent the next year and a half in Taipei, in Taiwan. And, you know, this was another kind of experience in having to be a little, fleet footed. We were originally thinking of moving to Hong Kong, but as we were approaching, it took us about 6 months to get there because we spent time in India and all through Southeast Asia. But by the time we were arriving on the shores of Hong Kong, expecting, to roll up and start work, the few replies that my wife, for example, was getting for job applications were, hey, we just laid off 20,000 people, or 20% of our workforce, or whatever. This is during the height of the 2008 bubble. So we had to kind of, re-strategize and rethink our next move. So we went to Taipei and just used that as a bit of a launching pad to spend some time up in China, having a look at their economy, spending a little time in South Korea and Japan, and just getting a feel for the Far East as opposed to having just been in the Middle East. Very, very different mindsets and different mentalities, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. I was having breakfast with a gentleman the other day, and for the mindset side, he was saying, living here in the Middle East, the Bedouins, they have this thing where they're so used to being on camel, being on in tents and stuff. When they would come across a date palm, they would go up and they would take every single date off of the tree. And, you know, because they don't know when the next time they would find a date palm. So that type of mentality and that philosophy has really, it's still applicable today. It's still ingrained in who they are. So I understand, like, when you talk about Taiwan, about moving there, it's going to be a very, very different mindset than here. Like, my wife is from China. Her and her family and everyone we know, they have a mindset where they don't use debt. Like, they don't have credit cards in that type of regard. If they have cash, they'll buy something. They put money aside. They have gold aside, but they don't use everything like right now, right this second. So I imagine that you probably saw some quite drastic changes between the two continents.
Yeah, that's an excellent example of the differing mentalities. I mean, I remember in shortly after we had moved to Taiwan, I was still working with Agora at the time, and my publisher, Addison Wigan, had released a documentary movie called IOUSA. And the tagline was, I think, a big budget movie, something like that. Anyway, it was being premiered. Well, the Taiwanese premiere was happening while I was there, and I kind of went along with a pencil and a pad and a microphone to get the reactions of some of the locals who had come to see this. And basically, the movie was about this, you know, the enormous amount of indebtedness that the United States government had dug itself underneath. At the time, those numbers, I mean, those numbers now look...
It's a dream. Yeah, like...
Infantile. Yeah, well, I mean, we would love to have under $10 trillion of only $10 trillion of debt. Now, you know, the spigots have been opened. History moves on. But at the time, those numbers were shocking. You know, people were looking at $10 trillion thinking, oh my goodness, this is, you know, an unheard of amount of debt. And so the movie went and spoke about not just governmental debt, but how that affected, you know, individual credit card debt, retail debt, all the way up and down the value chain. And we came out of the movie and, you know, I was interviewing some of my fellow moviegoers, and the looks on their faces, it was like we had just been to see some kind of horror movie. You know, people were aghast at the fact that individuals would not only not save some very meaningful portion of their income, but that they would over leverage, that they would actually be spending more than they earned, which to the Taiwanese mentality, this was, you know, you could almost watch their heads kind of, you know, explode on top of their shoulders. And we had some, I specifically remember two young women that were there that I was speaking to and asking, you know, for their take on the movie. And one of these young women was almost in tears, and she'd been so shaken by essentially an economics documentary. And she was kind of shaking a little bit and so nervous when she confided to me that she only saved 40% of her income, and she was going to go home and, you know, maybe ratchet that up a little bit because, you know, she wanted to guard herself against the kind of ills that were no doubt in store for the United States. So yeah, that was a huge shift in mentality from what we had seen from the Middle East you know, just some short months before.
It's just insane. It's crazy. But yes, absolutely. 10 trillion. Can we go back there, please? Can we have that again? 10 trillion seems like a dream.
And it's now exponentially running away. So, you know, you and I sit down and have a conversation in another 10 years. I don't know how high it can go, but it seems to be ramping up exponentially, which is probably not a good sign.
So this interview is kind of turning into This Is Your Life, Joel Bowman, but I am interested, where did you go next after Taiwan?
Oh, okay. So after Taiwan, I moved to Argentina. I'm a little bit of a bubble economics connoisseur. So I like to see catastrophe up close.
Up close and personal, right there in the thick of it, eh?
Up close and personal. Yeah, so I moved down to Argentina 2010, something like that. And you know, this is another environment in which real-time lessons in economics were on offer almost daily. So shortly after I moved down there, the local peso market started detaching from the black market down there, or they call the blue market. And so there were completely disparate rates between what you could get for, say, you went down there as a US tourist and you wanted to exchange some US dollars at a local bank, for example. You would get a particular rate, and this was, let's call it, say, 5 pesos to 1. But if you went to the black market, or cuevas, caves, they would call them, then you could get a meaningful difference. And the spread would be, you know, sometimes 20, 30, 40, 50% depending on where you went. So and the reason for this was because there were capital controls placed by the Argentine government on the population with regards to how they were allowed to move their, or how they were not allowed to move their money around. They were not allowed to invest in gold without providing huge amounts of personal information and all this kind of stuff. So the Argentine government had basically trapped the Argentine population into a fiat currency, the Argentine peso, that they were rapidly depreciating. And there was, you know, they'd really barred all the exits. And so there was a premium on foreign currencies like the dollar, like the euro, that Argentines would pay in order to escape their own peso-denominated disaster, looming disaster. And, you know, so it was, you know, you could read about Gresham's Law in economics books.
So I want to remind you to go to expatmoneyshow.com to pick up your free special report called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. We have had some really good feedback with this. It's actually a project I've been working on for probably about 4 years now and been offering it to my subscribers. And I am constantly updating it with the best and the newest resources for people wanting to go abroad. It is really amazing. I'm really happy with the work that we've done. And it's really different than a lot of the other projects out there or special reports or ebooks or anything like that. And this is one of the main differences. It is highly curated, it is highly condensed. It is not 400, 500 pages long and talking about every single thing out there and every single little detail. Actually, that doesn't serve anyone. Your best bet is always to go with the really, really condensed information so that you can connect the dots, so you can understand what's happening and how things fit together. And that's exactly what this special report does. So it's called 19 International Strategies to Grow and Protect Your Wealth Abroad. You can find it completely for free, 100% free at expatmoneyshow.com. Okay, enjoy, and let's jump back into the interview.
Is that bad money changes out good money?
Exactly. And you could look at that and you could process it theoretically and say, oh, okay, so this is how that would work in a closed economic system. But until you see people, you know, paying a 50% premium to get out of bad money so that they can save in good money, which is essentially what was happening. People would save in gold if they could get their hands on it. They would save in US dollars because it was so much preferable to the, you know, fiat script that the Argentine government was printing at a pace. You know, until you see that in very real time, it's not immediately intuitive why that law would hold. But it was, yeah, again, it was very interesting to see. And, you know, to see that spread widen as those spreads tend to do.
And did you have any business opportunities where you were working on the arbitrage there, or you were just watching it happen?
Well, I was watching it happen, but this was also the beginning of, you know, of other things like cryptocurrency. Well, at least the beginning of my awareness of them. So I was overlaying my experience with, private monies, public monies. You know, it was very complicated, but very interesting at the same time. We did have, you know, quite a few friends down there who we encouraged to open foreign bank accounts, particularly in Uruguay. And so, you know, people that we knew were able to save in non-Argentine peso denominated accounts. And in Uruguay, you can open dollar accounts and things like that. So that was a real you know, port in a storm for a lot of people who are undergoing, you know, fairly rampant inflation and, you know, just debasement of the value of their currency. And now I know, for example, this is quite some years on, but when we were there, when we first moved there in 2010, I guess, the peso to dollar exchange rate, I still remember, was about a pack of cigarettes. So it was about 4 Argentine pesos to 1 US dollar. And I haven't checked the data recently, but it's now something like 40 to 1. So yeah, it's gone kind of parabolic since then.
So how long were you in Argentina for?
I was in Argentina for 5 or 6 years. We spent half the year in Argentina and then half the year with carry-on only luggage, traveling around the world, trying to see some other things and visit some other places.
So was that because you were doing the perpetual traveler type of lifestyle and you were a non-resident in Argentina, or is that just purely for the fun of it?
A little bit of both, I'd say. It becomes an addiction after a while, I think. Maybe a kind of healthy addiction. But yeah, and there's always a, you know, you go somewhere and then you think, well, I'm only, you know, it's a short flight away from somewhere else and maybe I can just keep going. So, you know, eventually you end up just, you know, perpetually traveling. But we were not residents in Argentina. And in fact, I think it's, you know, to the extent that you can keep residency in one jurisdiction to a minimum, or to an extent that you can spend as few months in that particular place as possible, then that's probably to your advantage, you know, to keep on the move. I mean, not just to keep continually resetting your personal expectations, and, you know, to avail yourself to the kinds of surprises, that new cultures and economies and languages and flavors and all that kind of stuff avail to you, but, you know, also just as a, from a practical standpoint, we've only probably got another, well, I probably only have another 50 or 60 years on the planet, and there's a lot of places to get to.
Yeah. I've been at this for 20 years traveling around the world, and, you know, I've been to more than 100 countries, and I still feel like there's just so much to see and do. Like, how am I ever going to have enough time to do it all?
Yeah, I guess I completely agree. And I guess the paradox is, this is kind of like a Zeno's paradox. The more you see, the less you know. You know, when you have only been to a few places, then there's not necessarily that many questions that you might have on your mind. But it's the more places that you go to, you realize that we only have this tiny little amount of knowledge, and that there's so much more out there. And I don't think people necessarily appreciate that until they start traveling. I think that's why when people start traveling, they find it so very difficult to stop, because their appetite for acquiring knowledge becomes insatiable.
I think there's some famous quote that basically says that travel is the enemy of bigotry and closed-mindedness. And I think that's really true. You know, once you start traveling around the world and seeing different cultures and different perspectives and the way that people live their lives, you really question the way that you were brought up and the what you were told by the government and told by the schooling and all these different types of things. There's really 1,000 different ways that things can be done. And, you know, I'm Canadian, you're Australian. We're probably both taught as a young age that we're the best and, you know, our country is the best and our government is the best and everything we do is the best. And when you start traveling, you realize, like, it doesn't work like that at all. You know, there's so many different cultures, so many different experiences, so many different things to understand that you can't, I don't know, like, it's an interesting thought process, how we deal with these types of things.
Yes, I agree. I think it would be very, very difficult to maintain a robust prejudice against religion XYZ or a system of government XYZ or economy XYZ, having come from one and then gone to visit some others. It's just it's intuitive when people flip it around in their head, because people know when they go to, you know, the banks of the Ganges, for example, and they see cholera and typhoid and diphtheria victims being thrown whole body into the water 20 feet away from where some child is brushing their teeth. They immediately know that, it looks like something wrong with this picture. But rarely do they flip the switch and imagine somebody from another country or another culture coming to the chance place that they happen to have been born themselves, and looking through the outside perspective of that person's position and saying, hey, maybe, you know, you in Canada or me in Australia, if maybe somebody came over and had a look at the way that we've been taught to do things our whole life, perhaps it might seem absurd. And so all these things that we take for granted as being necessarily the best answer to all questions, until we really examine that very closely, then we just take things for granted, and that's no way to live.
Absolutely. So these days you're where? In Mexico, correct?
I'm in Mexico for 2 more weeks. And then I'm in Mexico City for 2 more weeks, and then I'm moving to Medellin in Colombia.
Oh, one of my favorite places in the whole world.
Yeah, we have a rule in my family that we're not allowed. It's a very arbitrary rule that we impose on ourselves, of course. But the rule is that we're not allowed to move to any city that we've already visited.
You've never been to Medellin, and you're moving there now?
Yes, I've never been anywhere that I moved to. So we've been to Colombia a few times.
Oh my goodness, that's so cool.
we've been to Bogota and Cartagena, Manizales, some other places around the country. So we know enough to know that we like it. We have a lot of very good Colombian friends from Colombia. So we know that much, but it just makes it all that little bit more exciting to step into the unknown. So that's going to be another adventure.
Well, I've lived in 7 different countries and probably 20 cities, but I'd say 90% of them, I went and checked it out first. I didn't just move the whole family there. So that's a pretty cool way of doing it. It must be pretty interesting. And then I suppose with you and your wife and your child and everything, you can experience everything together for the very first time. It's not like, hey, come and look at this restaurant I saw. It's like you guys go and do it together for the first time.
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that. I mean, you know, a certain amount of due diligence obviously is intelligent. I don't think I would move the three of us to, a complete unknown. But like I said, yeah, it's having some factor of variable in there kind of keeps it interesting. But you make a very good point. The three of us, you know, my daughter's 3 and a half. My wife runs her own business. I have, my own work going on. So we experience different places that we go to, obviously, very, very differently. And so it's interesting to compare and contrast those different experiences with one another.
Very interesting. Well, it's been really interesting to see, you know, the world, like the real life economic examples and things that you've learned during your travels, because this is not something I've talked to a lot of my guests about. We'll talk about the fun things of travel, which we've also done. But before we got talking today, you were talking about how you can internationalize your life, or how others can internationalize their life, kind of on the cheap, you know, on the shoestring. So through this world travels and living in so many different places, what are some of those other ways that you've found to do this?
Right. Well, straight off the bat, I mean, the cost of living is, you know, very disparate between different places in the world. So there's a very good chance that that wherever your listeners have grown up, they're paying a lot more for their cup of coffee or their, magazine, or certainly things like their education or their health insurance or their rental or accommodation situation. There's a good chance that they're paying a lot more for those things than they might if they chose to live in, you know, one of the 150 other odd jurisdictions around the world. So I often hear as an excuse for people who say that they would like to travel, that they would like to internationalize themselves, at the very top of the typically a long list of excuses is, well, it's too expensive for me. I'm not going to be able to afford that. Not taking into account that simply by moving to one of those 150 odd other jurisdictions, they'll already be enjoying a massive cost of living advantage. Even things like, I have people who say that, friends that would say they'd love to live abroad, but I can't afford it. And then they have car insurance and they have credit card interest repayments to make and, you know, all these other, probably largely unnecessary overheads. When you think about the kind of medical insurance that you can get here in Mexico, for example, you know, the advantages of taking an Uber around Taipei rather than, you know, garaging a car and paying auto insurance on that. You know, the idea of moving abroad and getting those kind of real world economics lessons that we were discussing earlier, and not going down the path of spending 4 years and $100,000 or more on a miseducation at some, you know, government institution. There are many ways that just by starting with a different frame of reference, you can immediately get out of the gate at drastically less expense than just staying put. People don't realize that the enormous cost of not going somewhere.
Well, my favorite one is when they use that same excuse of not having the money, but they're in a job that they hate. So what do they do on the weekends? They go in, drink their faces off, and spend $200 at the bar to, you know, repress and forget. And, you know, instead of living their dreams and going out there and experiencing the world, they practice escapism in their normal life. And it's like, well, if you put your money aside and, you know, you would have the resources to move, and the cost of living is so much less anyways, you might be better off. Like, I don't know. It's funny sometimes the way that people's minds work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's also interesting that the things that you think you value may not necessarily hold true when exposed to the light of another experience. So, for example, if you are, you know, growing up in your hometown, there's typically a pressure of, you know, what's commonly called keeping up with the Joneses. So the idea of, you know, my friend down the street, he got a new car, so I have to get a new car. And this person, they put an extension on their house, so I'm gonna do this. And it's a very, very, you know, it's a very slippery slope. It's only, I think, once you extract yourself from that kind of situation, that societal pressure. If you're living, you know, if you're a Canadian, let's say, or Australian, and you're finding yourself living in Ghana, there's going to be little pressure on you to, you know, be keeping up with.
Yeah, I don't know a Ghanaese name. What's a Ghanaese name?
you've got me there. But you're not going to spend your time, you know, trying to one up the guy next to you. You're going to spend your time trying to learn about his culture. You're going to spend time trying to work out how you can, make business together, or how you can, how you can explore different opportunities there. I think, you know, you quickly realize when you go back to your place of birth that oftentimes those really ostentatious displays of wealth are really just, they're tawdry. They're almost embarrassing. It's not, you know, showing off that you've got a new car, that you've heavily financed, or that you've gone deeper in debt to show everybody on the street that, you know, you've got a shiny new, vacuum cleaner or something. Those things don't really hold very much value in the long run, I don't think.
No, they don't at all. And I would be amazed that people still, I don't know, lack of a better word, fall for these types of things, because everybody understands how easy it is to get credit these days. And when you see someone with an expensive car, especially in North America, and a big house and, you know, all this new stuff, I don't think, wow, they're so rich. I think, oh, wow, they've got so much debt. Like that would strangle me. I wouldn't sleep at night if I had that type of debt.
Yeah, it's it can be crippling, of course, and you know, that's a difficult situation for people to get out from underneath if they're suffering this shouldering this enormous debt load. You know, for people who are in that situation, I mean, there are definitely things you could do. I mean, you could, let's say you lived in North America and, you know, you had a couple hundred thousand dollars debt on your house. I think that something you could immediately do, you know, downsize, get rid of that shiny vacuum cleaner that you don't really need, but, you know, learn how to use a broom. Maybe look at renting a room of your place out to try and, you know, bring in some income on what is essentially this huge burden that you've got over your head. And, you know, you could rent your entire place out on Airbnb or something and go live south of the border for a little while for an absolute fraction of the price, and probably live a much better, healthier, active lifestyle than you would in, you know, spending 2 hours commuting to that job that you hate that you mentioned before, and drinking your face off every weekend. That's probably not the best solution.
Well, you know, on this show, I often have lawyers on and we talk about trusts. We talk to, you know, gold vault operators, and a lot of these people have these solutions, and a lot of them are really interesting and they're fascinating and they make sense for certain people. But, you know, this is the Expat Money Show. If you're still at home in your home country and you're at a job that you don't like, you know, the first thing to internationalize your life is to leave. Like, get out there and start experiencing the world. You know, don't worry about all these other things, the second passports, the residency. Just get out and start experiencing life. Like, this perspective we were chatting about before, it is so fundamental. And then everything else will fall into place afterwards, you know? But you got to get moving. You got to go out there and see the world to actually figure out what it is that you like and what you need and what you enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, think of it like, you know, choosing, going to a fancy restaurant and the waiter coming over and asking you what you want for dinner, but not letting you have a look at the menu. I mean, just the fact that that people are doing what it is they're doing by default without having seen all of the options available, that the statistical probability that an individual has chosen the best possible life just because it was the life that was immediately presented to them, or in most cases prescribed for them, the statistical probability of that being your most advantageous application of time is next to zero. So at the very least, open the menu. At the very least, go somewhere else and, you know, challenge your preconceived notions and, you know, try and discover if you weren't just doing what you were doing because that was the default setting. I don't think anybody aspires to live a default life.
But we see it every day, which is, it's mind-boggling. But, okay, so step number one for most people, I think we can agree, is get out there and see the world, start experiencing things. What are some other things that are not going to cost people hundreds of thousands of dollars, things that people can put into place today which will help internationalize their life and protect their assets, protect their freedom from whomever, from the government, from the state, from all these types of things that we often talk about on the show?
Right. Well, I guess the first thing to do is to decide what value you can bring to the kind of market that you're moving to. So determining what advantage you have over, you know, the 120 million other people that live in a particular country that you want to go to, and how you can bring an advantage of knowledge or skills to the kind of market that you're entering, how you can bring a new perspective, you know, to wherever it is that you're moving. And, you know, that might involve, you know, building an online business. It might involve leveraging some local contacts, or, you know, really just differentiating yourself from the crowd. I mean, it's very, very difficult it's very, very difficult to stand out if you are, you know, the same as everybody else in your particular hometown, your home country, your place of birth. But if you move abroad, it quickly becomes apparent things that you can offer of value to that marketplace. So I guess identifying that first of all, and you won't, of course, know that until you move to those particular places, but go somewhere that is intriguing to you and right away try and think of ways that you could potentially add value to the market that is not common with your community. And so then you'll quickly discover that you'll be able to, not only will you stand out and will you be able to add value to your own life, but you'll be, you know, doing something that might not necessarily have been undertaken in your local community. So once you've worked that out, then, you know, the steps will follow on. Okay, how do I potentially derive income from this? Remember, you'll likely be living in a place with much lower cost of living than your hometown, at least when you start out. So your income doesn't necessarily need to be, you know, high six figures or whatever you might have needed to keep up with the Joneses. You know, it might only need to be enough so that you can rent a comfortable place, you know, with close proximity to maybe a shared workplace or something like that, and you can get your business underway pretty quickly.
Well, and I think for a lot of Western nations, when you leave the West and you start traveling, you know, you head over to Asia, you head over to Africa, places like this, maybe it was quite a competitive workplace where you came from, but your special set of skills and experiences, and I hate to say, but education might be massively beneficial to this new nation. And often they will pay very heavily and very handsomely to have you there and to share this knowledge and work in a certain industry. So I think it's important to look at things like that as well, because there's a lot of governments who have short lists of skilled workers or doctors or lawyers and things like this, where you can walk in and get residency very, very easily. And they're so thankful. They're so thrilled to have you there and to contribute to the economy. I think it's a very viable option that people need to look at.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I just wanted to underscore quickly what you said about different jurisdictions welcoming people. You know, your own accidental jurisdiction of birth, the presiding government sees you as a worker bee. It sees you as a tax slave. There's no two ways about that. You are there for, you know, to contribute to the health of the state, and you're treated accordingly. But when you move to or spend considerable time in places that's you know, where you're treated like a guest, you know, rather than a host for a parasite to feast on. That's liberating. It's liberating, emotionally, intellectually, to not stay in the pen in which you happen to have been born. It's a very different perspective through which to view life. And it's a perspective that lends itself to the creative process and to, you know, leaps in imagination that you might not have experienced otherwise.
Well, and I think back, and I can't say so much for Australia, but definitely in North America, the mentality is these are immigrants and they're coming over here to steal our jobs and, you know, go on welfare, and they're all bums, and there's such a negative connotation to moving abroad. But you know what? Like, other countries, they don't have this stigma. Like, you tell them you're from wherever your home country is from, and you're coming over here to work. They're thrilled to have you there. You're not looked down upon, you know. They never were brought up with this type of negative stigma about having foreigners in their country. It's a very different mentality of the people there.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, it was very interesting moving to Mexico, where I've been for the last year and a half. I moved here shortly after the U.S. presidential election. And as you know, irregardless of what side of the fence people fall on politically, there was certainly just a lot of heated discussion around the subject of immigration. And, you know, you kind of got the feeling that at least some meaningful percentage of the U.S. electorate had reservations at the very least, all the way through the spectrum toward sort of outright nativism and jingoism. And there were all kinds of, you know, mud-racking assaults and insults and whatnot being thrown across the aisle. But it was very interesting to, yeah, I've spent quite a bit of time in the U.S., but it was very interesting coming, you know, moving south of the border and finding really, really, really warm, hospitable, welcoming environment to, you know, for all intents and purposes, locals may well think that I'm an American citizen, American expat. But, you know, we would have people at restaurants and in bank lines and at the barbershop asking, oh, so where are you from? Really? You've decided to move to Mexico City? Wow. Thank you so much. How do you like our city? You know, within 20 minutes, it was not uncommon to have people invite us you know, to a restaurant or over their house for a home cooked meal, or, you know, any number of other interesting connections that you get to make to people. So there was, it was a real juxtaposition, you know, to just compare the two, you know, kind of cultural fronts towards immigration, especially during such a divisive time.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Joel, thank you so much for your time today, for being a guest on the show. If my listeners want to find out more about you, if they want to learn more about what you do, where can we send them?
Well, they can go to internationalmen.com. I'm working on that project with Doug Casey, who I know you've had on the project, on the program before, and Dr. John Hunt, who is his co-author in the High Ground novel series. So the three of us are over there at internationalman.com, and we're writing about all the kinds of things we've been talking about today.
And I've read many, many, many of your articles over there, and they are just phenomenal. So I highly encourage my listeners to go check out you guys' work, because there's lots of great stuff there.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
My pleasure. We'll talk to you soon. Okay, Joel?
Thank you so much.
Hey, everyone. Mikkel here. So I have an ask for you today. If you're enjoying this podcast, what I want you to do is go to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. If you want to leave us a 5-star review, even better. If not, tell us why. We are really doing our best to make this show the absolute best it can be, to help as many people to go offshore and inspire entrepreneurs and investors and business owners to move their businesses abroad. There's so much to be had in this industry. I love doing this work and I love doing this podcast. But we want to get the message out there to more people. And the best way to do that is with reviews. So if you have ever gotten one good tip, one good thing from this show, if you enjoy listening to us every single Wednesday or whenever you listen during the week, then please take 30 seconds out of your day, go out there, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It actually makes a big difference for the show, for the visibility, and really helps get the word out there. So I appreciate that. Thank you so much, everyone, for your support.
This episode may be over, but your journey to greatness continues by visiting our webpage and signing up for our newsletter. For convenient access to new episodes, show notes, and other crucial resources, visit expatmoneyshow.com. We look forward to you joining us on the next episode of the Expat Money Show. Safe travels.
Every month, we offer exciting new webinars for our community. Topics include how to use retirement accounts to buy real estate overseas, how to get a second passport in Latin America, why you should sell your stock portfolio and move your money offshore, how to buy beachfront rental properties in Brazil for less than $100,000, or apartments in Paraguay for less than $60,000. If you want to join us for free for these presentations with live Q&A, insider secrets, and exclusive opportunities with my professional network of experts, then go to expatmoney.com/webinars. That's expatmoney.com/webinars to register for free upcoming presentations. expatmoney.com/webinars.